You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, it is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM in mid-Missouri. Over two millennia ago, the early Maya formulated a profound galactic cosmology. They saw that the sun on the winter solstice was slowly moving toward the heart of the galaxy. Naturally, they suspected that the world would go through a transformation when the solar and galactic planes aligned. They devised their long count calendar to target when the cosmic alignment would maximize, and that time is 2012 AD. These brilliant sky watchers who devised the 2012 calendar left monuments for us to investigate and decode. These monuments have survived the decay of centuries so that we can know exactly what these amazing people prophesied and believed about the time that is fast approaching us in the next 5 years. John Major Jenkins is an independent researcher who has devoted himself to the reconstruction of this ancient Mayan cosmology for over 20 years. He's a good friend of the program, a good friend of mine personally, and it's an absolute pleasure and a thrill to welcome him back to the program. John, pleasure.
Hi, Mike. It's great to be back speaking with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the air, John. And like we mentioned off the air just a little while ago, it's been a year. It didn't seem like that long, but it was August of last year, last time we talked.
Yeah, time flies. It could be that time speeding up thing, which maybe at some point in the program I can present a either funny or weird theory I have on the time speeding up idea.
Well, I think we'll do that. There's a lot of questions about synchronicity and this sort of thing that have been coming up over the last few weeks. So we'll definitely get into that in a little bit. But before we do that, I wanted to start out with something. I mentioned, I'm not sure if you're listening, but before the break I mentioned this this man, Johann Goethe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a favorite of mine and is, but he talked about something that's sort of related to the business that you're in. It's this idea of what was called the perennial philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to just read something really quickly that he had said, and then maybe you can just launch off of that and we'll get going with that as a starting point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But Goethe said, "All truly wise thoughts have been thought thousands of times, but to make them truly ours, we must think them over again, honestly, till they take root in our personal experience." And I thought about this idea of the cyclical nature of time, and how there really is no thing new under the sun. It's just a matter of rediscovering old and perhaps lost knowledge. And maybe we could start with that sort of idea.
Well, I really like that sentiment, and I've been a fan of Goethe's myself. And, yeah, he definitely was into the perennial wisdom. That quote that you just had there, really interesting, because it basically makes the distinction between knowledge through passive obedience to something somebody else instructs you in versus having the direct experience of something yourself, which is really the more important way of coming to knowledge. In that quote, it was like, you know, all the great thoughts, you know, have already been thought by others, and somebody can certainly come along and just tell us about that, or we could read Plato or something like that. But there's a huge difference between that kind of learning, which is, you know, kind of discursive, Socratic, you know, external imprint of information, versus the inner Gnostic realization, you know, that little mini realization that we can get when we understand inside of ourselves the great wisdom teaching. So it's that distinction between inner gnosis and mere external information.
Yeah, there's a difference between actually knowing something and hearing it or reading about it or, you know, seeing it on CNN or whatever. There's something about the actual experiential side that makes it concrete.
Exactly.
All right. Well, okay, good place to start. Before we go further, though, I want to ask you a little bit about what's been going on. You've been real busy, and I'd like you to sort of bring us up to speed on what you've been up to for the last year, if you can sort of summarize for us. I know you've done some conferences. You've got some new audio. You've got a brand new audio collection that's out that's really nice. And I don't know, maybe just sort of bring us up to speed on what you think's been going on out there.
Well, there have been a lot of developments, and I believe that going back to December, I was sending in reports by email from the trip to Azapa.
Yeah, that was thrilling, as a matter of fact, when you sent us a note after you confirmed the alignment on the solstice morning, I remember.
Right. That was pretty significant.
Tell people the details of that, John, if they missed it.
Well, Azapa is a very, very important site. My research is involved in the Maya calendar, and the Long Count calendar is the calendar that gives us this incredible 2012 cycle-ending date that many people, of course, are talking about. And my research has been involved in trying to understand why the Maya chose 2012 to highlight a great cycle-ending. And although it might seem common sense, nobody else has really taken the position or the approach that I've taken, which is to examine the culture that invented the Long Count calendar.
What a novel idea.
Yeah, it's, you know, you had the ancient Olmec people, and then you had the Maya people, of course. Between the Olmec and the Maya was this short-lived culture or civilization called the Izapan culture. It flourished between about 400 BC and 100 AD, and it was really this interim transitional culture that formulated some of the core institutions that were later adopted by the Maya, including this Long Count calendar. So in that little preamble introduction that you gave, where, you know, it's important that there are monuments left that we can examine that'll tell us something about the Maya cosmology and calendars, that quote is actually referring to this site and the carved monuments that are surviving at this site. So that's really unique to my approach and my work to understand 2012,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, based on the sort of value assumption that we can or should study the authentic Maya information that will lead us to understand directly for ourselves what they intended 2012 to mean.
Have you been speaking to groups about this over the last few months?
Well, yeah, that's been sort of the second part of the travel that I've been involved in. That trip back in December was involved in going to the site of Azapa and making measurements to confirm that there are solstice alignments there. And
you even designed a little contraption to sort of measure it, didn't you?
Yeah, very simple sort of zenith azimuth measuring device that you need to calibrate with a GPS clock, which I brought with me. But it's a very simple device that one can set up and calibrate to high noon, and then you have around the dial the correct azimuth positions that will indicate sunrise on the solstice, for example.
Okay.
So it's people can go to my website to check it out, alignment2012.com. I thought it'd be important to bring an instrument that could actually measure the solstice sunrise, although I was there with the express purpose of being there at dawn on the solstice anyway, so I could observe it for myself.
Right. And if you missed the website, people, and this is a good chance to hop on over there and take a look around, John's site again is www.alignment2012.com. And in fact, there's a I haven't seen it in the last 2 seconds here, but I remember, John, that you do have a page devoted to that exact thing that we're talking about that describes the events of of that trip.
Yeah, it's linked off the homepage there. And I've just made some updates to the website, too, so there's new stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that trip was an important trip. You know, it's not necessarily easy to jump on a plane and get down to obscure sites in southern Mexico around the holidays, especially because there's always other stuff going on around Christmas and New Year's. But I managed to do it this time, and it was an important trip. And so then this year, 2007, has been packed with a lot of conferences and speaking engagements. There seems to be really feels like there's a greater sort of interest now in the popular media. And I have been sort of trying to combine business with pleasure. I did a driving trip out to the West Coast, and I did conferences in San Francisco, Ashland, and Portland,
mm-hmm.
and camped out in the Redwoods along the way. It was a long 4-week driving trip out from Colorado and back around, and visiting family near Seattle and visiting friends in Missoula. And the events in Ashland and Portland were especially important because a friend of mine in Portland, Bill Maxson, had helped me organize and set up the events in Ashland at the university there, and then another event in Portland. So we had a real grassroots interest in, you know, the information that I present on 2012 and Azapa.
What has been your impression of the crowds that you've been speaking to? How are you being received these days?
Well, there's kind of a paradox in my research a little bit, because for me it's kind of a deepening Gnostic journey. You know, my work for me is always progressing deeper into the perennial, you know, sort of like a peeling back of the layers of the onion to have a deeper understanding of how the perennial principles, the universal principles that I've uncovered at the heart of the Maya calendar cosmology, you know, once they're identified, then it's almost like one has a living relationship with them and a deepening understanding of how they relate to everything else. But the paradox is that 2012 is like a clarion call for people, and it seems like every few months or so there's a new bumper crop of people that are becoming interested in it, so are entering the discussion on a fairly novice level. And so one has to be able to address sort of the beginning stages of coming into, you know, an encounter with this profound Mayan wisdom, which in many ways is almost the inverse of the assumptions that have been drilled into us from Western education and so on.
Right.
Although people like Goethe and other people involved in esoteric studies through the centuries understand these kind of things. For example, that real knowledge only comes through one's own inner Gnostic relationship. Real knowledge doesn't come from studying graphs and data and making, you know, the scientific method results in a kind of surface understanding of reality. It's sort of like making a map and then looking at the map, but it doesn't really yield a real understanding of the territory unless one has something else going on in relationship to it.
Right, right. You can look at the map and, you know, get a feel for what it might be like, but until you get there on the ground, it's really absolutely, completely not the same, yeah. Well, let me ask you about the nature of your audiences. I'm interested in the people who've been coming out. I'm trying to get a feel for sort of the throb of the zeitgeist, you know. Are they younger people? Are you getting people, you know, that are like you're in my age? Or are you getting, who's coming out?
That's a good question. I think it's slowly morphing and changing. One sort of has to understand the 2012 story, you might say, and the 2012 movement as the 2012 meme first appeared in the 70s, and then with Terence McKenna's work, of course, although Terence, you know, came at 2012 from his own work with the I Ching and novelty theory and so on.
Mm-hmm.
A big sort of imprint for how the 2012 idea has been framed since the early 80s has been the popular movement under the direction of José Arguelles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listeners may know that I've offered some critiques of the dream spell theory, and it's not really based upon the authentic Maya calendar tradition. And it carries with it a certain set of assumptions about how the Maya calendar is to be engaged. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, it basically comes sort of with a heavy burden of sort of 1980s New Age publishing, where, you know, it's all about creativity and, becoming a daykeeper yourself, you know, without any regard for actually going through authentic initiation into the Maya calendar priesthood, which still exists today, and some people do go through official initiation into becoming daykeepers. So there's kind of like this poser sort of thing that has gone on with the Maya calendar. And of course it can be valuable to track the days and engage with the day signs as an oracular device, you know, consulting it as an oracle. And to answer your question, I think there's almost like two generations that one can identify in audiences. One is sort of an older generation that probably comes to the Maya calendar through having some kind of experience with harmonic convergence in 1987.
Mm-hmm. Again, back to the Arguelles connection, right?
Right, the Arguelles connection there. And that can be a valuable thing. But again, there's this sort of implied sort of approach that it comes through going to sacred sites and having celebrations and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What I notice is that there's a growing interest among younger people that are, you know, really interested in this information. In fact, the band that you're playing, Canal, really, really great music. And
yeah, they're from out your way.
Yeah, they're from Colorado, and a group of young musicians working together with the great spirit of togetherness. And I guess the story is that they got together and conceived the band while they were visiting the ruins of Palenque.
It's true that the guy that is the vocalist, the lead vocalist, he goes by the name of Tzol, T-Z-O-L.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually interviewed him briefly. We talked for about 15 minutes last year. I featured their music on an earlier program, actually when I had Jose on the air. And yeah, they had a real interesting story about how they all got together, and some real talented people writing some real cool music.
And I think that they have sort of internalized a lot in their lives that allow them to accept the broader implications of the Maya calendar teachings, you know, that it's about coming back into right relationship with our true selves, which, you know, one can listen to the previous interviews that we've done and understand my whole rap with that and how it's linked up to the 2012 date and Izapa and the teachings in the Maya creation myth. But there almost seems to be, with the younger crowd, sort of an already in place, matter-of-fact sort of acceptance of some sort of spiritual concepts that have really been more difficult, I think, for the older generation to sort of grok. You know, coming from, you know, there's just generation-specific assumptions and blocks and so on. Or maybe it's just that the younger crowd already sort of are evolving, you know, and are already sort of primed to take it to the next level.
And they have, you know, these days, everyone has access to a lot more information than we've had in the past, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's a part of it. The children that I'm in touch with are remarkable in that, well, in lots of different ways. I look at my own son, John. I mean, you've seen him anyway. At any rate, I can't imagine at 3.5 years old me saying the things that he says or doing the things that he does. And I look at the way, you know, children manage computers and, you know, the new technologies that the older people sort of struggle with. And it does seem to be an evolution of sorts. They just are introduced to stuff at an earlier age and can grasp it intuitively, where we have to learn. It's like learning a language when you're 40 versus learning a language when you're 4, you know.
Mm. It must be a pressure cooker, though. It seems like there's a denser field of information or that they must integrate, or what Marshall McLuhan would call a hotter environment.
That's,
you know,
right.
It's just more information dense.
Right.
And
right.
I suppose there's kind of a premium, a high premium for those who can do that, but then it's almost like once it starts to take place, then it becomes more of a norm. Because I really do believe that the human mind is capable of so much more.
Well, don't you? I mean, isn't that, maybe that's a good chance to talk about the Maya? I mean, because these people, from a mental perspective, I mean, just their mental ability, it seems to be far exceeding what we think as normal. I mean, these people were outrageously intelligent.
Right. And intelligent in a way that I believe can be referred to as multidimensional or holistic. I always make this point about the Maya calendar because when I do interviews sometimes that question always pops up about, well, wasn't the Maya calendar just incredibly accurate? And then 5 decimal points or 6 decimal points or some sort of, you know, reference to incredible accuracy, and then we're supposed to just be in awe. Well, accuracy is a value of our own Western scientific tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Maya calendar is accurate to a certain sense. I always believe that that statement was overplayed, because the real important thing about the Maya calendar and the philosophy of time that goes with it is that it's comprehensive. It perceives the universe as a great interwoven field of nested cycles, bigger and smaller, the microcosm reflecting the macrocosm. So you have this field of cycles in nature, including dimensions of nature that would be called organic or human or agricultural or astronomical. What we perceive as sort of separate domains, the Maya saw as being interwoven in this vast field of interconnections. That comprehensive multidimensional vision, in which multiple domains of experience that surround us are seen to be interwoven, that's really the beauty of the Mayan mind. And I really believe that many indigenous cultures, just by nature of having allowed the mind to unfold in an unhindered way, have some version of this. It needs to be stressed that Western civilization is really the anomaly in which the potential of the human mind has been narrowed and constricted into basically obsessing on three-dimensional reality as being like the premier thing. And so, in fact, the Western intellectual mind field is an incredibly constricted and limited domain.
All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, just a few minutes after the midnight hour now on the 28th of August. We got an amazing full moon just showing herself beautifully out there out the window. We got a total lunar eclipse that's on the docket for the next, well, coming up in a few hours, and just a remarkable night, John. It's great to have you on the air on a night like tonight.
It is an auspicious moment.
Sure is.
Eclipses are always special times, the transcendence of opposites.
Well, let's talk about something that's related to that. The Mayan calendar looked forward a long way. In other words, they were interested in looking at things that were going to happen long after they departed from the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there are alignments that are involved in their mythology and storytelling as well. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the actual events that we think are going to occur, actually the events that we know are going to occur, and how it ties into the Mayan cosmology. And, you know, maybe just a little bit of background for people. There are certainly some that are joining us for the first time and might not be fully up to speed on what the whole business is about to begin with.
Okay, well, let's see. The structure of the Longtown calendar involves these large periods and small periods. There's basically five place values. So you have different cycles, and the big cycle is this 13 Bakhtun period. By the way, Osh Lahun, the title of that canal song, means 13.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2012, it's the end of a 13 Bakhtun cycle.
And how long is a Bakhtun?
A Bakhtun is just under 400 years.
Okay.
So a full 13 Bakhtuns is 5,125 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the calendrics of the Maya calendar, and but it connects in with the Maya mythology. The Maya creation mythology envisions a sequence of four, or some people see five, world ages, these big cycles of time that humanity goes through, these different chapters. So clearly there's a connection between the Maya creation mythology, the world age doctrine, and the large periods in the Longtown calendar. So 13 Bakhtuns would be one world age.
Hmm. John, that's pretty interesting. When I just think 5,000 years, roughly, that puts us at about 3,000 B.C., maybe 3,100 B.C., and that is essentially when history begins.
Yeah, people have noted that, and that certainly is an intriguing observation. That doesn't mean that the Maya were around in 3,000 B.C., inventing the calendar, though.
Hmm.
The calendar was really invented probably around the 2nd or 1st century B.C., and what they did is the beginning date of the calendar is most likely a back calculation.
Hmm. But again, if you know the math, you can go backwards, forwards, and if you know the cycles, then the things will sort of fall into place regardless of whether you knew it or not.
Exactly. There seemed to have been an interest in the numerology, the mathematics of these large cycles.
Hmm.
But I believe actually that the target for placing the calendar in real time was their projection forward to this rare alignment that takes place at the end of the cycle in 2012. So that's kind of the linchpin of the whole theory. And again, it's a little bit counterintuitive to what Western science or Western thinkers might assume, you know, that, you know, a culture would hang their calendar on the end date in the cycle rather than the beginning.
It is funny because we tend to concentrate more on the past than we do on the future. In other words, when you look at our own calendrics, you know, Western Christian calendar, Gregorian business, you know. I mean, hell, we don't look more than 12 months ahead. That's as far as we go. We buy a calendar maybe at the beginning of the year, or your dad's boss gives you one with his company's logo on it or something.
That's
know?
Right, yeah.
And that's as far as we look, really. We don't really consider what may be happening 2,000 years ahead or something.
Yeah, not so much. And also to conceive of the past as being the primary causative agent is also
right.
Not something that's necessarily implicit in the architecture of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's really more of a cultural assumption.
Right. We could just as easily be being pulled from the future as we are being pushed from the past. There's no reason to assume one way or the other, really.
Right, which in theology is called the theory of teleology.
Mm, teleology, sure.
Teleology, which it basically is a sort of an inverse way of looking at cause and effect. Cause and effect is so deeply ingrained in our Western science and philosophy, and it lends itself to the Darwinian model of evolution, and it's just so deeply embedded in Western thought that, you know, one cause leads to effects, and there's a sequence of you know, cause and effect, basically. Well, that certainly does work very well as a model, especially if one's perception is fixated to the world of three dimensions. But we know that the universe has many more dimensions than that, and the arrow of time is not necessarily running from the past to the future, so there's definitely a lot more going on in the universe than, you know, the standard bearers of Western science have been able to perceive. So the Maya seem to have been tuned into this sort of inverse way of looking at things, in which the end of cycles is where the important event happens. In fact, the event that happens at the end of the cycle is the thing that determines the events that unfold during the cycle. So for example, like the Maya perceived that birth happens at the end of a cycle. In fact, their 260-day calendar, which is really the core building block of the Maya calendar system, mm-hmm. is templated upon the 9-month, 260-day period of embryogenesis. Mm-hmm. And birth happens at the end. So likewise, in the larger cycles in which the Maya were interested, it's the thing that happens at the end of the cycle that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So 2012 then comes into focus as a kind of teleological vector in Mayan metaphysics or Maya time philosophy. And in my research, there was a key that I stumbled across that really is the key to understanding 2012 and why the Maya were looking forward some 2,000 years. The early Maya, the people who invented the long count calendar some 2,100 years ago, they placed the long count calendar with an intention to target this rare alignment that culminates in the years around 2012. Basically, the sun on the December solstice will be lining up with the bright band of the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way arches overhead, and it's kind of like a great white road in the sky, almost like a finish line. And people can go to my website and click on the link, "What is the Galactic Alignment?" to get a three-dimensional sort of a graphic to sort of grasp how this works. And it's an empirical fact, you know, it's not some New Age metaphysical, mystical concept or something.
Right, the astronomical fact of the matter is that this thing is actually going to happen.
Yeah.
John, could you try to paint a little bit more of a clear picture about the actual, try to an image so people can see what it might look like, you know, if they were looking at a, you know, a three-dimensional sphere of the solar system, and then the galaxy. Is it the plane of the solar system that lines up with the plane of the galaxy, or how does it exactly work?
Okay, I usually like to envision this from the vantage point of the Earth, but we can sort of step above the whole thing and try to look at it objectively. There is the plane of the galaxy, which is basically the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm. And it's like a disc-shaped thing, basically like a saucer or something.
It's a disc-shaped thing viewed from some higher objective position, but
right,
since
right.
we're inside of the Milky Way, mm-hmm. it appears to us to merely be a line, because
mm-hmm.
we're inside of the equator. We're inside of the Milky Way,
right,
so when
right.
we look at it from inside, it just looks like a... it's basically a circle of light that encircles the Earth. But yeah, the Milky Way is saucer-shaped, and it's a disk, and it has this, you know, bulging area where the galactic center is located, saucer-shaped. And that's the plane of the galaxy. Now, the plane of the solar system is basically the ecliptic. It's referred to as the ecliptic, which, from the vantage point of the Earth, is the path in the sky that is followed by the sun, moon,
mm-hmm.
and planet.
Mm-hmm.
And... That is the plane of the solar system. Now, the plane of the solar system intersects the plane of the galaxy at a 60-degree angle. And it's like there's two great circles or two hoops that surround the Earth, and they intersect at two points on opposite sides of the sky.
Right.
So there are two points at which the planes of the galaxy and the solar system intersect, and they do cross at a 60-degree angle. One of those crossing points is in the constellation of Sagittarius, and the other one is opposite that, in the constellation of Gemini.
Okay.
And these crossing points were really interesting to the Maya. The cross form itself, the crosses formed by the Milky Way and the ecliptic, were called the Maya sacred tree, and the Maya recognized these places in the sky. So those are fixed. We just have to envision those crosses as fixed.
Okay.
Now, the way that the alignment works is this. Somewhere along that great circle of the ecliptic are located the position of the sun on the equinoxes. And perpendicular to that, those two points, we might call this the sort of the equinox axis. And currently, the equinox occurs in Aries. So there's a specific place on the ecliptic where the sun is on the equinox. But because of this phenomenon called the precession of the equinox, it's basically caused by the slow wobble of the Earth on its axis, the position of the sun on the equinox is slipping backwards along the ecliptic very, very slowly.
And this is precession, right?
Yeah. This is the precession.
Mm-hmm.
So although we must envision the plane of the ecliptic and the plane of the galaxy as staying fixed, the position of the sun on the equinox is actually shifting along the ecliptic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, what's really being affected by this precessional wobble is both equinox points and both solstice points. So we can envision this four-spoked wheel that the ends of the four spokes touch the ecliptic, but this four-spoked wheel is slowly rotating. And the two equinoxes and the two solstices, the position of the sun on those days, is constantly shifting backwards along the ecliptic.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically the phenomenon that the Maya were tracking. And what they noticed is that the position of the sun on the December solstice will be lining up with the Milky Way, with the plane of the galaxy in the years around 2012.
Right.
Not only that, but it'll be lining up with that part of the Milky Way where that great bulge is, the nuclear bulge of the galactic center. So that's why the alignment phenomenon, well, it can be talked about with varying levels of precision depending on the terminology one chooses to use. There's visual features involved in this, too, that are central to the Maya creation mythology. That's why this is, initially one encounters this information and skeptics sort of throw up all kinds of, roadblocks to sort of accepting it, one of which is that it seems so abstract and they must have had telescopes or something. Well, not really. When you look at this, there's visual features involved in the alignment. Those features are front and center in the Maya creation mythology, so we know that they were thinking about them. And we have the science of iconography, which studies the symbols that the Maya use on the carved monuments and so on. And we have pretty well understood connections in the iconographic symbols to astronomy. So we have that sort of Rosetta Stone equation going on.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at all this information, and this is basically what I've done in looking at the site of Azapa, the carved monuments from Azapa. And there are monuments there depicting deities from the Maya creation mythology and other astro-mythological features, and we can basically interpret these carved monuments as depicting the alignment of the December solstice sun with the galactic center.
Mm-hmm.
And when you realize that that is a era-specific alignment that happens in the years around 2012. It's an astronomical fact. Then we must conclude that the people of Azampa were intending to indicate this era as being significant.
Hmm. This alignment, it reminds me of, well, you talked about teleology a little bit ago, and the idea of the end of a cycle resulting in a birth.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a little bit more about that, because I think teleology as sort of universe with a purpose, in other words, sort of the opposite again of what our intuition is, that things are driven backwards, but that things are actually being pulled towards some sort of an ultimate objective. Maybe you could riff on that a little bit, because again, if the 260-day cycle is representative of the birth of a child, for example, what are these longer cycles representative of a birth of?
Right, right. Well, just as an aside, as an image, teleology can be thought of as the equally valid perspective that, say, for example, the purpose of a tree is the fruit. So that just sort of gives a sense for how teleology works. And it's perfectly valid to think of it in that way. The entire purpose of the tree is to produce the fruit. And then, of course, the fruit contains the seed, so the seed falls to the ground and produces another tree.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great cyclic process going on here. There are these larger cycles, and I believe that the Maya were tuned into an understanding of these larger cycles that, by analogy, can be understood to be producing a kind of fruit. And it's sort of the image that the universe is an unfolding flower, and consciousness, I believe, is the flower that's being produced. The unfolding of the inner essence inside of created beings. This happens in an individual life. You know, if one's engaged in a spiritual path, we can nurture and facilitate the unfolding of the latent inner seed of our own divine beings, our consciousness. When we nurture consciousness, then we're bringing into being the sort of original mind. And the original mind is that infinite and eternal source consciousness from which everything springs, including us. In a similar way, I believe that, I don't know, I guess you might say the purpose of evolution is to produce not just self-reflective beings, but beings who are in contact with their deepest essence, their deepest center and source. So this starts to get into the sort of metaphysics and the philosophy of the Maya, which in my studies what I've found is that the Maya were tuned into the great perennial philosophy. And they, in the deepest sense, they had an understanding of how the universe comes from this eternal, infinite, unconditioned ground of all being. And then that eternal, infinite ground undergoes a limitation and projects itself into limited forms. You know, material existence comes into being. And, you know, this is sort of thought of theologically as the cosmogonic fall. Fall of eternal consciousness into a state of self-forgetting.
The fall into history.
Yeah, to become incarnated beings, you know. Now, this is all part of the great processes of cyclic processes of time. You know, there's a darkening and then there's a lightening.
Mm.
And this is all perennial philosophy stuff. So the Maya were really tuned into these things.
You know, John, the idea of 2012... versus 2007, for example, where we are right now, in the scheme of the thing, you know, thousands of years, we're only 5 years away. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the fact that it's more of a window almost,
yeah,
you know, rather than just a specific point in time. But we're certainly very, very close to this situation right now, or we're in the middle of it, perhaps.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I kind of wanted to go on record, although I've been saying this for 10 years or more, that there's really no reason to expect something specific to happen on December 21st, 2012. So all the people that are going to be calling me or emailing me nasty things in January of 2013 saying, I told you so or something, I never said that. So I just want that to go on record. Now, that doesn't mean that that 2012 does represent what can be thought of as like a sociological target point. I think this is especially relevant to the Maya Renaissance that's going on in traditional Maya areas. And we can talk about this more when I can sort of relate some of the things that happened on this recent trip to Central America, and we can talk about that more. But as far as the window, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, 2012 is sort of defined by this rare alignment. I like to... The alignment itself can be talked about with varying degrees of precision. And the whole argument as to how the Maya... Well, the whole thesis that I have in regards to whether or not the Maya intended 2012 to target this rare alignment really comes from looking at the core institutions and how the astronomical features that are involved in the alignment are front and center in these institutions, like the ball game, the creation of mythology, king-making rituals, the monuments of Azapa. This is an approach that nobody else has taken. So my results are basically standing alone to be looked at without precedent. And there's really a sort of an uphill battle that I've been engaged in. Apart from that, so that's a whole separate question. Now, about the alignment window, for very specific reasons, the shifting process really can be thought of as a window that stretches from, say, 1980 to 2016. This is just based upon the astronomical parameter that the sun itself is half a degree wide.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take 36 years for the sun to process through the galactic equator,
mm-hmm,
which is the precise midline of the Milky Way.
Right, okay.
So the solstice galaxy alignment, or the alignment of the December solstice sun with the galactic equator, is factually true for the window or alignment zone between 1980 and 2016. So that's, of course, you know, places 2012 within that window,
mm-hmm,
it basically indicates that the Maya were incredibly accurate with their forward calculation of precession.
You know, and on a practical side, it seems like, you know, it will become self-evident anyway. You know, I mean, if 2012 rolls around or 2013 rolls around and, you know, the theocons are still running the show and, you know, it's the same old business as usual, then we know, well, you know, maybe it wasn't, you know, what we thought it was. But, I mean, if we do, between now and then, see changes, you know, in the way that the world works, in the way that people, you know, live their lives, again, it will be something that by then perhaps we'll say, oh, well, sure, because it's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it is an interesting thing to contemplate. Maybe there is a sort of a built-in alarm clock to these processes. You know, I mean, certainly people feel that we are approaching a juncture, sort of a, you know, a break point with the ecological crisis and climate change and political things and so on, that the world is approaching sort of a do-or-die sort of situation, that we need to change our values.
Yeah,
and we've inherited this world that is based upon this set of assumptions and values that perhaps worked well enough for the last 200 years, but but it's not leading to a sustainable future.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the conscious reevaluation of reality that must take place. It's like an examination of conscience, of collective conscience, in a sense, in regards to how we design our lives, where our values are at. Are we any happier because we can jump in a car and drive 800 miles before the sun goes down? I mean, is that really making our lives any more valuable or better in any real sense?
Right, right, right.
So there's all these things, and of course, people that are, you know, you and I, we've basically inherited this lifestyle in which automobiles are central. And so we take it for granted. And, you know, there's a certain amount of grudging acceptance, or I don't know what the word is. I mean, we basically just accept the thing that's been handed to us. But when one looks at the oil conglomerates and the psychopathic corporate agendas that are going on in the world today revolving around oil, not to mention the wars that get started in order to secure more oil,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, I think this is really sort of the focus of the transformation that needs to happen. And it should be said that the Maya believed that cycle endings would be times of great transformation and renewal,
mm-hmm.
you know. For them, even 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, yes, they have this calendar that had a big cycle ending way off into the future, but also all the little cycle endings in their calendar were sort of like mini, what would you call it, mini tests or mini replays.
Mm.
The same, it's the same dynamic.
Yeah, the whole thing's a fractal, you know, thing, and I guess the calendar sort of reflects that too.
So they were practicing the things that we need to practice in the years leading up to 2012 or in the time around 2012. The ancient Maya were practicing those same things at the end of their 20-year period or the end of their 400-year period.
Right, right.
And so on and so on. And basically those practices are the practices that are really important to embrace in order to facilitate a successful transformation and renewal. These are sort of spiritual teachings, I guess you'd say, that are embedded within the Maya creation mythology, which is really a beautiful source of that encodes not only the galactic alignment in 2012, but also a prophecy with the various deities and characters involved in the creation mythology, but also spiritual teachings. And those spiritual teachings revolve around sacrificing our attachment to illusions, the illusions that bind us to states of limitation, and, you know, unexamined habitual behavior patterns and so on. And so those things are embedded in the Maya creation mythology. And that's also sort of an approach that I've taken to the material, is to honor and respect the first primary documents of the Maya heritage and legacy that are luckily survived for us today to study.
Amazing. All right, look, let's take a little break, okay?
All right.
All right, it's Mike, and it is Radio Orbit. Once again, John Major Jenkins on the web, www.alignment2012.com. John, thanks for sticking around.
Yeah, still here.
All right. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, well, I'd like to talk about the prophecy first, briefly, just because people are curious. What was the prophecy? Everybody wants to know what the Maya thought perhaps may be coming. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, but then I do certainly want to talk about hucksterism and charlatanism and marketeering and all this stuff, because I know that's going to become something that we're going to have to pay attention to.
Okay. Well, the prophecy for 2012 is embedded in the Maya creation mythology, which again is about, it's a world age doctrine, so it does speak to these cycles of time and things that are to occur at the end of the cycles. There are various characters in the Maya creation mythology, and basically in a nutshell, there's one particular mythological character called Seven Macaw. He's the vain and false ruler that appears, and at the end of a cycle, Seven Macaw, he's basically the archetype of out-of-control, narcissistic, self-serving egoism.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what's going on in the world today. Not only with, you know, the most visible exponent of the
archetype. We tend to pick on our own, you know. You know, it's true, but the stuff's happening sort of everywhere, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening everywhere, but it is on the rise, and it seems to be the mode of the world where you have self-serving not only people but institutions. For example, the corporation is an entity that is basically defining the globalization of the world, and the corporation, as described by an author named Joel Botkin in his book *The Corporation*. There's also a great video out that he has on this. A corporation is basically follows and adheres to all the characteristics of a sociopath, a psychopath. And there's 7 points that he goes into, and he shows why this is. So it's not only insane, self-serving leaders like we have here in the United States, but it's also what's really driving the leaders behind the scenes is this Frankenstein monster known as the corporation.
Right.
You might see, you know, basically, so the Maya prophecy, as we see it in the creation myth, and also it must be said that the carved monuments of Azapa that I talk about all the time, they depict these episodes from the Maya creation mythology involving Seven Macaw. He's a bird deity, and there's all these episodes that are depicted on the carved monuments of Azapa. So the Maya prophecy for 2012 is that consciousness will be fixated to the limited level of the ego. Now, the ego has always served a function. And in times when human beings are connected to the true eternal self, the ego is in a state of correct relationship. In other words, the ego orbits the true eternal self. And the consciousness is really rooted in the true eternal self. But in the great cosmogonic fall that inevitably happens in the great cycles of time, that connection to the true self gets cut. And at that point, the ego gets deputized to be, or to perceive itself as the true center. This is the fall into history. This is where the ego inflates and grows to the point where it sees only itself as the arbiter of all things. It doesn't even recognize that there's this other eternal, infinite, true self from which it comes itself. So the prophecy is that ego will be ruling and ruining the planet. There's a second part of the prophecy, however, that involves how the Hero Twins come along and do away or sacrifice or put ego in its place. And this is the challenge at the end of the cycle. It's the challenge of how we can, and sacrifice is involved in this, which of course is a very central teaching of the Maya. It's not the sacrifice of the heart or blood or anything like that. It's the sacrifice of our illusions that keep us bound to the state of limitation in which we believe that ego is the only thing. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's really the subject of my 3-CD program that I have coming out next month with Sounds True.
Yeah, we should mention that, actually. I was fortunate enough to get a copy of it.
Called Unlocking the Secrets of 2012.
Right, a new 3-CD audio collection, right?
Right, and I have a special offer on my website where if people want to pick it up directly from me through my website, I'm going to toss in for free a 2-hour presentation DVD. That's sort of a limited time offer, but I really think this information is really important coming out now, and it really presents sort of the next stage in my own evolving understanding of these things especially in how there's a specific sort of there's spiritual teachings that are embedded in the creation mythology as well that can help us make this transformational transition to place ourselves back into right relationship with, you know, the true reality. And this is really needed right now. I mean, it all sounds kind of mystical and metaphysical or something, but, you know...
Yeah, look around us, though. I mean...
Yeah. That's not to say that we... See, this has to go hand in hand with a tangible work that we're doing in order to transform our culture's institutions into institutions that are sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can have a sustainable future, sustainable lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an outer world sort of work that's done, but there's really a more important inner world work that needs to be done, because the distorted institutions like the corporation in the world that really come into being because of an internal situation. So we need to sort of be doing the work on both sides of the equation at the same time.
Okay. All right. Onward to a little bit of discussion about... I've sort of got a thorn in my side about this a little bit, because I'm seeing all kinds of so-called experts popping up here and there, writing books and getting lots of PR and stuff. But they're people that I have never heard about, and I know from my own understanding of your work and other people's, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the people who've been involved in this for a long time, and I sort of recognize that there's sort of a going after the green buck in a certain sense for some people. Would you mind? It might be a touchy subject in a little way,
no.
But maybe you could talk about it a little bit, because I think it's important, because I think there's a lot of bullshit, frankly, that's going on out there.
It's part of the whole 2012 story, and I've been very interested in tracking things that are coming out and theories that are being presented and other books that are coming out and theories and so on. Yeah, I think in the most unfortunate, lamentable side of the discussion, yeah, there's going to be the most gross kind of marketing of doomsday, for example, and that's just basically another effort to go for the jugular with the fear,
right,
you know, fear-mongering
thing,
right. And all this stuff, and I guess people just need to exercise discernment in order to, not be controlled by fear. See, the way that ego keeps us fixated to and in allegiance to ego is through fear. You know, so that's part of the work we need to do, is to recognize that when, you know, institutions or people or books or whatever, they're pushing the fear button, that's usually a sign that they're not really out for our best interest, but only to keep us locked into places of limitation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apart from that, which is pretty easy to recognize, there's kind of another zone that I noticed is happening lately, especially. There's a lot of insightful light workers or teachers, you might say, that have been tuning into self-actualization methods. Sometimes it involves traditional perennial methods such as meditation, and there's various forms of guided imagery and self-exploration and healing, you know, that... people are doing really interesting work along those lines, and that's great. You know, I think that people have responded to that. But what I notice is that sometimes the certain names that are already recognized in this field are called upon to comment on 2012.
Hmm.
Well, 2012 can be seen in a sort of simplistic way as sort of a time to grow spiritually. You know, it's like a crisis time or something like that, or an opportunity, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of an easy, generic sort of interpretation of it that doesn't even require reference to the Maya or the Maya calendar or the traditions that are associated with that. So in kind of a quick and easy way, a so-called expert or you know, an expert in these self-actualization techniques can simply plug the 2012 topic into their already existing rap. And, you know, this happens, and it's a little bit, I don't know, to me it's kind of like it's a fairly quick and easy way to plug into the 2012, to jump on the 2012 bandwagon, you know, and I suppose it's not all bad. In my own preference is that we would really try to recover the authentic and original Maya teachings around 2012. That's what I've been trying to do, mm-hmm. and language through my work with the Maya creation mythology and the monuments of Azapa. My conclusions sometimes dovetail with what other people are saying is a good thing to do. Like, for example, meditation. It's the great standby, you know, for deepening our insight into our true natures. But the way that I am able to sort of parse out the spiritual teaching of meditation as it exists inside of the Maya creation mythology is something that's done in respect and by way of honoring the authentic teaching, you know, because it is there. So I think it's valuable, especially if we're going to talk about 2012, to recognize that 2012 really came into the popular imagination through through the Maya tradition. Mm-hmm. It is an artifact of the Maya calendar. Now there's a lot of course, there's, you know, 2012 has really grown into a whole, you know, grassroots phenomenon, and people do talk about 2012 without any reference to the Maya. Again, I think this is a little unfortunate, because my sense of where this is all going, if we can frame the discussion and guide the discussion correctly, is it's basically going in the direction of filtering, how do I say this? It's basically a way in which the Maya people of today can experience a renaissance, and there is a movement in traditional Maya areas going on right now,
mm-hmm.
in which younger Maya people are being educated. They're taking positions of leadership, political leadership, and religious, spiritual leadership. They're sort of emerging out of that, the dark age that was forced upon them by the conquest.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Guatemala especially are experiencing an intellectual and spiritual renaissance of Maya culture. And I believe that, and what I've always been interested in doing is facilitating the resurgence of the Maya themselves. And this is a tricky thing. It's not going to happen overnight. I believe that 2012 can be a rallying cry for this to happen. There's signs that the Maya themselves are starting to understand the importance of this artifact from their ancient ancestors.
Right.
And it should be... What's that?
Well, it's amazing how deep the repression has been. In other words, it's been 500 years, and it's just now people beginning to get a grasp on their own history.
Exactly, and it should be said that the long count calendar, as a tradition, fell into disuse hundreds of years ago. So there's no specific information surviving among the modern Maya about the long count tradition per se, the long count calendar itself. But what's happening is that there are certain deep understandings that survive among the modern Maya. For example, there's a author named Gaspar Gonzalez, who a friend of mine, Robert Sittler, has been working with. Gaspar Gonzalez is like a Mayan philosopher. He's a traditional Maya daykeeper and a traditional Maya who's been educated and can talk about his tradition, although some of the information doesn't come directly from his elders. It comes from his own study of the Maya tradition in the way that I've done, or my scholars have done.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the 2012 date. He has an understanding about 2012 that although he doesn't really talk about my alignment theory, his focus is on the incredible narcissistic megalomania that's running rampant over the planet today. And then there's sort of teachings on how this can be, you know, reeled in and brought under control. So he's kind of like he's expressing that prophecy, that ancient Mayan prophecy for 2012. It's really, really quite striking.
Amazing. How did you run into him?
Robert Sittler is working on a translation of a book that Gaspar Gonzalez wrote. Actually, when I was in Guatemala several weeks ago, I stumbled across his book, which is in Spanish, and it's about the 2012 date and about Maya leadership and changes that are going on in Guatemala.
You know, I guess the other side of this is that, you know, any information, any literature, any books that are being written with regard to this topic, if nothing else, even if the information might not be exactly accurate, they're certainly raising awareness of the topic in and of itself, whereas, you know, people may read a book and it may not be particularly, accurate, but it might strike their fancy, and then they may go out and look for more information. The next thing they know, they've got a new audio set from John Major Jenkins, you know. So I guess, the raising of awareness is happening one way or the other.
Well, I've tried to make as a writer, as an author, and a conference speaker, and a teacher, I do try to make a living doing this, so I suppose I'm sort of engaging in that marketing thing myself, but that's not really my main focus. It's an interest in clarity and discernment as this material emerges into popular awareness.
Mm.
Right now, the 2012 phenomenon, there's just a whole spectrum of different perspectives and misunderstandings and insights and approaches to the whole thing. There's almost like different nodes that people can enter in through to the whole discussion. And my hope is that for many people, this can be sort of an initiation and an ever-deepening understanding of the perennial philosophy, because although one might enter into the 2012 discussion through what I consider distorted pop sort of information, if a person has a discerning, questing spirit and heart, one will find themselves getting deeper and deeper into the perennial teachings. And that's where one's own spiritual journey can really take off and have that ever-deepening initiatory relationship with the perennial universal principles that create and sustain the universe and help us all evolve.
All right, John, that's another good place to take a little break, okay?
All right.
All right, we're top of the hour, everybody. Just a little bit after 1 o'clock here. You're listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. The program is called Radio Orbit. We're speaking with John Major Jenkins from Colorado. You can find out information about John on the web at www.alignment2012.com. He has a number of books that he's written over, oh my gosh, going back almost 20 years now. John, you started this whole business around 86, 87 or so, right?
That's where my travels began. Journey to the Mayan Underworld came out in 1989. It was a limited release, sort of self-published thing.
Well, and lots since then. The one that struck me and so many other people was, of course, your book on 2012. Name escapes me right
now.
Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, of course. And that was, what, 97 or 98, I think that came out. But
yeah.
Anyway, tremendous stuff that you've been doing for many years now, and a brand new 3-CD set that's being produced by Sounds True. I have a copy of it right here in my hot little hand, and it's not only is there a bunch of great information on it, but it's very well produced, and it's a nice package, and they did a really nice job. John, you should be real proud of it.
Well, I am, and it's great to be working with the people at Sounds True, and we can also talk about the anthology of writings that they have coming out next month.
Yeah, we'll do that in a minute, okay?
All right.
My guest tonight is John Major Jenkins. We've been privileged to have him on the air with us a number of times before over the last couple of years. It's great to have him back on the air tonight. There's always plenty to talk about with John. and we will continue it right now after I say his website, www.alignment2012.com. All right, John, hi.
Hey.
So, a question that came up at the break, and I'll just throw it in just because it's sort of fun. A person asks about the construction of the Mayan pyramids, and if, you know, I know that you know so much about the monuments and things down there. I wonder if you'd be interested in addressing this question about the pyramids. He asks if they are perhaps some sort of information storage units as well as architecture. And I think of, the reason I ask is because I think about the cathedrals, you know, and this sort of thing, books of stone, the idea that information can be encoded in architecture. Obviously, there's information encoded in the architecture down there. What do you make of the pyramids?
Well, yeah, this is, of course, a whole other aspect of the research. One way that the Maya pyramids encode information, they're, you know, four-sided and the point at the top. So if you were to look down from above, you'd see the four corners, and then you'd see the point in the middle. This is information that encodes Maya cosmology, really. The Maya pyramids were like cosmograms. They were symbolic representations of the structure of time and space, because what you have there is the four directions unified by the central fifth direction that points up into the zenith of the sky. And you also have encoded in there the four ages, the four previous ages, unified by the fifth age, which is in the center. That sort of unifies the energy of the four previous ages. It's kind of like the way that the you know, the four basic elements, earth, water,
air and fire,
fire and air, are unified by the fifth element, space.
Ah, the quintessence. Yeah,
yeah. And so that's one way. I guess I don't know if that really speaks to the question directly, but another thing is that the Maya pyramids could be oriented in specific ways to the horizons, and in a way that's similar to the Egyptian pyramids. Some researchers have found proportions and in the sides of the Maya pyramids that relate to the sacred science principles.
What is it? The golden section, the golden mean, this sort of thing.
Right. These are really the perennial principles or sacred science principles that I refer to in my research, and they're mathematical and they have philosophical implications as well. And the mathematical side of the sacred science principles, what I found in my early research is that they basically relate to the mathematics of the Maya calendar, so
okay.
It's pretty amazing.
All right, but I'm going to shift a little bit here. You said something earlier that that stuck with me, and you mentioned this idea of getting ego in right relation to the rest of the experience of life. And we've spoken about it before on the air, the idea of the psilocybin mushroom and its relationship to the Mayan priesthood and the shamans. And of course, ego is something that gets addressed when you take psilocybin. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because I do think that it's important to address the actual religious side of this and how these shamans actually acquired the information that they got in order to create the whole mythology to begin with.
Okay. Well, let's see. There's two things in there that I'd like to talk about. One is that shamans would use mind-expanding substances in order to circumvent the sort of limiting filter of the ego identity. If we're sort of stuck to the ego identity, then we see things through the filters of our immediate self-awareness, and everything's kind of filtered through that sort of limited bubble of our awareness and self-identity. And shamans could use these tools. Sometimes it was psilocybin mushrooms, sometimes it was dimethyltryptamine extracted from toads or other plant material. Anyway, there was a whole shamanistic science that was and is still used by shamans today. And one aspect of this is to come to an understanding of, to have insights into the universe. And again, this is the method of going within to understand how the architecture of the deep psyche works, and then by analogy, understand how the architecture of the universe works. This is based upon the great hermetic adage, as above, so below, which could also be understood as the microcosm reflects the macrocosm. So the inner world of subjective experience that is opened up to the perception of the shaman will reveal the way that the objective universe is constructed.
And again, John, it goes back to what you spoke about earlier with regard to direct experience versus, you know, knowledge gained through, you know, somebody telling you something or you're reading it in a book or whatever.
Right, exactly. So I do have a section in my book, My Cosmogenesis 2012, in which I talk about psychedelic cosmologies. And it seems that at the site of Azapa, especially, the use by ancient sky watchers and astronomers and shamans of these mind-expanding substances was a way that they could come into insights about the cycles of time and the universe and so on. We see this also in other tribes, like in South America, the Desana, the Warari.
Mm-hmm.
The Kogi and other groups would come to cosmologies, cosmological models of the universe. Sometimes they were very geometrically based.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty fascinating stuff. I wrote an article for Daniel Pinchbeck's website, realitysandwich.com,
mm-hmm.
in which I talk about, and it should be archived there somewhere, about psychedelic cosmologies. But I think that's a really important way of understanding the role of psychedelic plants in the formulation of these profound cosmologies.
A person in the chat room just sends me a link with a connection to some Mayan mushroom stones.
Oh, yes. That's the reason why we believe that shamans were using these things at Azapa, because at the time of Azapa's heyday, some 2,000 years ago, we have mushroom stones, like ritual objects mm-hmm. that are shaped like mushrooms, dated to that era in the region of Azapa. So it indicates that there was a mushroom cult going on. And there's also carved monuments at Azapa that indicate the Bufo marinus toad was being used mm-hmm. and harvested and so on.
Right, 5-methoxy DMT,
yeah.
Right.
Now, the second thing that I wanted to talk about in relation to the circumvention of ego with these substances is an important factor, and it basically relates to not only the psychedelic experience and how that can have beneficial spiritual results for people, because I don't think it's automatic. One thing I'm learning more and more is I used to assume that anybody that had this experience would automatically sort of have an understanding of spiritual dimension, at least the reality of the spiritual dimension,
mm-hmm.
and that would sort of, that conversations could be had,
right.
you know, based upon some kind of similar experiential set.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've realized is that some people don't necessarily think of the experience they had in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, even though they had some kind of bizarre experience, it's often categorized as just, you know, in a certain compartment in which it was, oh, just got fucked up.
Right.
Tripping out or something like that.
You know, my experience of the thing is similar. I agree with you. But I also think there's a side of it that gets ignored by the great majority of us. And this is just my impression, though, is that we tend to think that it's just a chemical thing that's happening, that we eat a mushroom, and just because of the chemistry that exists inside this particular organism, well, then we have these experiences. My intuition and my experience is that, yes, there's chemistry involved, but there's also an intelligence involved, and that intelligence that comes along and through the mushroom, that is the mushroom intelligence or the mushroom genies or whatever that I like to call them, and they're a part of the experience as well, and they can decide, you know, how much they're willing to give, how much they're willing to share, what the nature of the experience might be, depending on what the human being brings to the table as well. I think that it is very much a two-way street and sort of a partnership thing that goes on.
Absolutely. It's a partnership thing because the experient, the person who's undergoing the experience, is absolutely part of the equation of what happens. So what I was going to say about this then is there's an important factor in the psychedelic experience that, you know, brings it into that makes it comparable to other spiritual traditions such as meditation and so on. And I think the important unrecognized factor is the concept of sacrifice or surrender. Let's call it surrender.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who do these things know that it's important to not clench up, to let go, to surrender. To surrender to the flow of what's happening, and to the extent that one can do that, one will go more deeply into the experience and have a more more fulfilling and interesting experience. So I think that this also applies to the 2012 question, especially in regards to the galactic alignment.
How so?
What's going to happen in 2012? The galactic alignment.
Mm.
But that still doesn't define what's going to happen for each individual person.
Right. What's the actual practical effect down here?
Right. So it's kind of like, yes, you can take 5 grams of mushrooms, but unless one has a relationship to it that is basically humble and willing to surrender
mm-hmm.
one's desire or need or reflex to control, one has to sort of lay one's ego on the altar of sacrifice in order to have the best experience possible.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's also an aspect of the length of relationship. In other words, I really do look at it as a relationship, like any relationship, like a relationship to a significant other or to a friend or whatever. And you know, you can have a one-night stand, and it can be fun, and, you know, you might learn something or whatever, and it might be dreadful. You never know, right? Just like a mushroom experience can be on a one-time thing. But if you go back, you know, and you work on the relationship, just like any relationship, usually it will bear fruit, and it can become much more beneficial in the long term than maybe just the one-nighter, you know?
Absolutely, and I think it's about willing to experience, having the willingness to experience, and being open to the mystery, because we really don't know what is going to come into our field of experience.
Right.
Except I do sort of feel like where we are at in our inner intention can, to some degree, draw into our experience either negative or more positive experiences.
I think that's a fair statement.
I don't know. Maybe that's probably at least a possibility, but there's always still the random wild card factor in the whole thing, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, Terence used to say that, you know, there were many ways that people attempted to access, you know, these different realms. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, there's meditation, all kinds of different techniques. There's drumming, there's, you know, ordeal in the wilderness. There is dancing until you go into an ecstatic state. And then there are the plants that are used as helpers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I do recognize is that, you know, before you eat those plants, those mushrooms, man, your knees are knocking, because every time is exactly as you say. You don't know what's coming. There is that wild card, and you can prepare as best you can, but, man, you may be thrown overboard, and you may just have to hold on for dear life for the next 5 hours. You just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen when you walk into the ashram.
That's right. That's true.
You know, you pretty much know what you're going to get.
Right.
Maybe that's why it's, you know, a lot of people talk about it, but very few people actually do it.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there is kind of a connection between that experience and what the alignment represents.
Huh.
Because once you take the 5 dried grams, something is definitely going to happen. There's an empirical thing that is going to happen.
Right.
In the same way that the alignment is an empirical thing that is happening.
Right,
going
a physical
to happen.
Thing that's going to happen. Yeah.
But really, what happens depends on the kind of relationship that we have with it, whether we are open or closed.
Hmm.
I think that's really what it comes down to, and that's why I keep talking about sacrifice or surrender, because that is the key for the Maya that drives history, sacrifice. And so that's kind of a strong word. Some people don't like it, but it's just to say surrender. When people meditate and they do the breathing meditation, it's about focusing on the breath and surrendering more deeply into simply paying attention to the breath and going more deeply into the present moment, surrendering one's, you know, mind, the one's attachment to distractions that are keeping one from going deeper.
Right.
So surrender and sacrifice are the indispensable keys to these things, whether it's meditation or sweeping up around the ashram. I mean, I suppose if one could abandon oneself to the experience of sweeping around the ashram, it would only take 1 hour of sweeping, you know, until you were hit with Satori. You know.
Right.
But then there's that brings up the whole thing about future projecting and sort of, you know, that the ego will try to keep us from having that ego boundary dissolving experience, because it breaches the integrity of the ego. And
it looks at it as a death, I guess, of sorts.
It's tyranny. Well, it is a death. It's the great initiatory death that is talked about in all the esoteric and exoteric traditions for spiritual growth, you know.
Let's talk real fast about initiation and about perhaps the relationship between death and birth.
Well, they're two sides of the same coin. I really think that that's true, because especially in the initiatory esoteric mystery schools, the death experience is really the beginning of spiritual life. It's a temporary death of the ego. It's a dying to the ego so that the spiritual self can come to the fore. And I sort of don't like that terminology around it, because it implies that the ego dies and that sets up this kind of false dualism between the ego and the true self, which is not really correct, I don't believe. The ego...
The ego has a place, right?
Yeah, it will continue to exist within the larger field of the true eternal self.
Yeah, I mean, you need your ego just so you know whose mouth to put the spoon in. And,
right.
You know?
And the ego can be made transparent so that the wisdom and consciousness of that true eternal self can shine through. It's just because we've made our egos opaque, you know.
And totally dominant.
Right. And so all of our consciousness is wrapped up in that one little bubble. But we're, you know, I love that old saying that we're multidimensional beings who have settled for a lot less. So it's kind of like at the end of the cycle, everything's fixated onto the limited field of the ego, and it becomes the challenge and the opportunity to, change things so that everything's put back into right relationship.
Okay. All right. Let's not take a break. You want to take a break or you want to not take a break?
Whatever. Don't really need to.
All right, let's just roll. And I got so many things here that are coming at me, and I'd like to just keep going if you don't mind, okay?
Okay.
Time as a variable thing. We tend to think of time as something that is not variable, something that, you know, a minute is a minute, it's always the same, and time just will never change. Maybe talk about the counterintuitive idea of time as a variable, and then I'd like to talk about synchronicity a little bit and what it means and what we're experiencing in our own lives with regard to synchronicity.
Well, time is a variable. I really think of time as being a subjective experience, and because of that, the flow of time, whether it's going fast or slow, will be a function of how constricted or open our consciousness is. And this gives me an opportunity to present my clever model of time. And basically, you know, people talk about time speeding up a lot.
Yeah, everyone's saying it. Oh, yeah. My gosh, time's going faster and faster.
I'm not sure if time speeding up is really built into, is really intrinsic to the nature of the universe. What I think is going on here is that at different epochs of history, more things are happening. So like more events are happening within a given sector of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that I think of this is sort of the analogy. Time is like water moving through a garden hose. And it can move faster or slower depending on how many events are happening. So the hose itself is our consciousness. So in a sense, time is flowing through our consciousness. Now, if the water is moving faster and the consciousness or the diameter of the hose itself can be enlarged to accommodate the increased flow, and in doing so, the water will slow down. So it's kind of like the way that you can pinch the end of a garden hose and make the water go faster.
Right.
In a similar way, two people can be experiencing the same flow of events, but one of the people is experiencing that same thing as going very fast. It's because their consciousness is constricted. And the other person who's experiencing the events as being just sort of ho-hum and it's going slowly, their consciousness is open. So time speeding up is more a function of how constricted our consciousness is at any given time rather than something that's intrinsic to the architecture of the universe.
Okay.
Just sort of my funny idea around it.
Well, I like the analogy, actually.
The other funny idea is that notice that time has been speeding up ever since people have been drinking a lot more coffee.
Well, I don't drink coffee. It's still speeding up for me.
Okay. Oh, there goes that theory.
maybe it's pushing it for sure. What about synchronicity? Let's talk a little bit about what it is. And one of the ideas that sort of goes along with everything that we're talking about is the idea that synchronicity should be increasing as we move closer and closer to the end of the cycle. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes, synchronicity, at least in the way that I understand it, is the how seemingly unrelated events pop up in one's experience, and yet they have meaning. So there's like meaningful connections happening between seemingly unrelated sequences of events.
Coincidences, kind of?
Well, kind of like coincidences, except coincidences don't carry
The weight of a message.
Kind of meaning factor that synchronicity does. Synchronicity is actually sort of revealing a deeper connectivity in the universe. Coincidences are sort of just like random, meaningless things.
Right.
I think that synchronicities signify the popping into our awareness of a deeper interweaving of things that appear to be unrelated, but as our consciousness approaches sort of a deeper or a higher comprehensive vision, then synchronicities start to appear more frequently because we're starting to sort of pierce the veil of appearances that that keep events apart, one might say.
What are you experiencing in your own life? Could you give us an example of something that you know may have happened to you that was synchronistic in nature?
Well, I'd like to share something. I'm not sure if this really qualifies as synchronicity, but it was pretty strange. Several years ago, I wrote a novel, and it's called Remembering 2012, and it was kind of an exercise, and I had a character in there, and the character goes to, kind of loosely modeled on myself, the character goes to Central America and has certain adventures and experiences, and for example, goes to Copan and gives a presentation at the great site of Copan.
Mm-hmm.
In another episode, the character experiences a great numinous opening when the volcano Fuego spews some lava and smoke from the town of Antigua, which is a town in Guatemala that I really like and have been to many times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I went to Central America just last month on this tour, I actually experienced going to Copan and giving a presentation in front of 100 people.
Huh, amazing.
And then a week later, I was in Antigua the day before I was to leave for this another conference venue, and Fuego was spewing lava and smoke.
Huh.
And people in Antigua said that this did not happen for 30 years.
Wow.
So it was almost like, you know, my imagination coming true in reality or something.
Hmm.
I don't know. What have you experienced along the lines of synchronicity?
I don't know. I get things like, you know, I'll be reading a book. I had this thing happen not long ago. I was rereading a book by Colin Ross called Bluebird, and it was sort of a dark book. It's about MK Ultra and all the human, you know, radiation experiments, basically all the nasty stuff that the U.S. government has done to its own citizens for the last 50 years, right? But anyway, I would get in my car, you know, after, and this is typical, it happens to me quite often these days, and, you know, I'll pull behind a truck, and there on the mud flap of the truck, it'll say Bluebird, you know, and it'll have a little blue bird, and I'll think, my God, and you know, then I'll read a book, I'll be reading True Hallucinations, and then I, you know, and a truck will pull in front of me, DMT transportation, you know, or something. And I look at it as like signposts or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if the signposts are there to say you're on the right track or the wrong track, but I think that can be sort of discerned once you get used to what you're looking at. But certainly there's signposts to say something, that, you know, you're on some sort of a track.
Well, I think the theoretical basis of synchronicity is pretty much understood in, you know, psychology and so on. It's, again, that microcosm reflects the macrocosm, mm-hmm. and our subjective experience reflects objective processes. And I think that the idea that as we get closer to 2012, more synchronicities will happen.
You know, John,
yeah.
I'm just thinking about tonight. I mean, you and me, we didn't plan to do this show tonight on a full moon lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a synchronistic event, in my opinion. The fact that you and me are on the air tonight talking about all this stuff, and we've got a major celestial event that's going to happen in just a couple hours here.
Right.
And the fact that we were on the air exactly a year ago, and I didn't realize that until today. I mean, there's some sort of cycles that seem to impress themselves upon us whether we like it or not.
That's absolutely true, and that's what I experienced also in Guatemala. Was when I did a presentation in Antigua, I looked up what day it was in the calendar, in the 260-day calendar,
mm-hmm.
and it was my birthday in the 260-day calendar. That kind of thing with your birthday in the calendar happens a lot, especially
incredible.
When I travel to Maya land.
Huh.
And anniversaries, one-year anniversaries, those are critical. The fact that there's an eclipse happening.
Right.
And the eclipse is a symbol of the transcendence of opposites.
Oh, man.
And that's what the synchronistic experience is, I think.
Hmm.
It's
hmm.
the way that, you know, some kind of sign in the external world meets with the meaning faculty in our own inner inner world. And, I, you know, that's just an astounding thing. And, I think that it's not necessarily, automatically going to happen more and more as we get closer to 2012. Again, I think it's a function of consciousness. Because when consciousness is in greater unity with its essence, that's when I think synchronicities happen more.
Remarkable. Because that's exactly what I think a lot of people are experiencing.
I think so. It's kind of an opening up into a different modality. It's a modality that's freed from the cause and effect limitation that's imposed upon us from, you know, Western science.
Yep, Western Cartesian science.
I like to think of, you know, that's sort of a logical construct. I like to think of synchronicities operating in the realm of analogical process, analogy-based thinking or perception, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of consciousness that perceives relationships between patterns such as river delta and tree branching and things like that. These are not just simply poetic metaphors. These are actually windows into the real way that the universe is structured.
Amazing. All right, a question from a listener. Mike, I'd love to hear how John came to meet Marty Matz.
Oh, huh. Marty Matz is the co-author of a book that we wrote together, more or less. It wasn't really published until after Marty died.
It's Pyramid of Fire?
Pyramid of Fire, yeah. Basically, as I recount in that book, Marty gave me a call in 1994, and he was given my phone number by Terrence McKenna.
For people who aren't familiar with Marty, what was Marty's deal?
Marty was a beat poet and sort of a perennial philosopher and kind of a wild and crazy character. He was an expatriate who lived in Mexico for many, many years and then lived in Thailand. And he produced a wonderful book of poems called Pipe Dreams during his sojourn in Thailand with his wife Barbara, who I'm still in contact with, and she's a photographer and an artist in her own right. And so, yeah, Marty was involved in the recovery of this document called The Pyramid of Fire, based upon an Aztec picture book, and that was the subject of that book that we worked on together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one more here that came in from the web. Could you touch on what, if any, part Kamazats has to play in the end of the cycle? That must be a character in the play.
Kamazots?
Kamazots? Kamazots?
Is that a... Never heard of it.
Though. Yeah, neither have I, but maybe someone's playing a trick on me there. You never know.
Got to Google it, I guess, to see.
Kamazots.com. Somebody else figured it out for us, okay? Okay, the 11th Hour Convention, what's that all about? It's on your website.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is a very important and very uniquely designed event. The 11th Hour Convention is happening at a resort south of I think it's between Tulum and Cancun.
Man, they just got whacked by a big storm.
I know.
Holy
yeah.
cow.
And it's an experiential, interactive conference. It's more than just a conference. It's really an experience where people will be able to connect and discuss Mayan teachings and spiritual teachings with myself and many other people. And really, if one is interested in that, one should go to my website and just click on that banner that's on my front page to find out more about it.
Okay. And again, that's at alignment2012.com. And yeah, just page down a little bit and you'll see a little banner there. It says 11th Hour Convention. It's at the Mayan Riviera, the 7th or the 10th through the 17th of November. Wow, it's a whole week-long deal, huh?
It is, yeah.
Huh, incredible. All right. The other thing that I've been meaning to add all night is the New York Times. That was a big deal.
Right. In July 1st issue of the New York Times, there was a piece that came out that was designed to be a piece on 2012, and there was a fortunate set of circumstances that allowed me to talk with the writer of that piece, Benjamin Anastas. He flew out here to Colorado to interview me for the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was assessing the whole spectrum of 2012, and it's a pretty difficult field to slice into. You know, there's a lot of competing and differing sort of approaches to the topic. And you know, he was out here at a time when I was going to introduce the 2012 Odyssey documentary that Sharon Rose and Jay Widener produced. And it was showing at the Oriental Theater in Denver. So I was able to go to that with Ben, and I think that my conversations with him really helped him understand what I think is a good approach to 2012. And it happens to be my approach, but I still think it's a good approach, and it's one that's not really been taken by other writers on the subject. And that is the idea that we can come to an understanding of 2012 by studying the site that invented the 2012 calendar.
Mm-hmm.
That site is the Zappa, and it also allows us then to, you know, because the carved monuments of the Zappa are portraying events and episodes and spiritual teachings that are in the Maya creation mythology, it also allows us to then understand 2012 through the teachings in the Maya creation mythology. So it's a way to honor and respect the authentic fundamentals of the Maya calendar tradition rather than sort of doing a little research and then doing a cut-and-paste thing to come up with one's own model or system or something like that. And so I'm really grateful that the New York Times saw fit to have some focus on that approach, because I think that it's really important as we get closer to 2012 to honor the traditional authentic Maya teachings, the ancient Maya teachings, as well as the authentic Maya voices that are doing incredible work today. For example, there's a Maya writer named Victor Montejo who wrote a book called The Maya Intellectual Renaissance, came out with the University of Texas Press. And he's a Maya, traditional Maya daykeeper and teacher and philosopher, you might say, from Jacaltenango in Guatemala. And he's an interesting voice.
Hmm.
I think we need to put our efforts behind the Maya Renaissance that is starting to happen. And I think that my work is kind of a stepping stone into that realm. Otherwise, some of the other options on the menu of selections is sort of idiosyncratic and unconnected from the authentic Maya teachings.
All right. Well, the last thing I sort of want to touch on, just to sort of get a clear picture from your perspective, is this idea of paradise or Armageddon. You know, the 2012 thing is being sold or attempted to be sold by a number of, you know, organizations or entities or whatever you want to call them as, you know, the next latest greatest doomsday scenario. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that, perhaps.
Well, I think that the apocalypse will be true to the extent that people don't look deeply enough into the phenomena.
Again, it's a matter of how conscious you are, the way it affects you.
It's kind of a superficial conclusion about transformation. You know, it's transformation is a very profound concept that can be meditated upon, and one can come to deeper insight and understanding in regards to what transformation is and how we can participate in it. And to sort of, you know, because really it should be said that in the creation mythology of the Maya itself, there is this doctrine of world ages, and at the end of each world age, it's about transformation and renewal. It's not about Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
Armageddon is a specifically Judeo-Christian term,
right,
it should be said, and more importantly, it's intrinsic to the linear philosophy of time that is so central, you know, to the Judeo-Christian model.
Mm-hmm.
So by saying that 2012 is about our Armageddon is like a total conflation and mixing up of two completely different perspectives on time and two completely different traditions. You know what I mean? It's kind of silly to do that because Maya time is really cyclic in nature.
Interesting.
And even though we use terminology like end date or cycle ending, that's just a linguistic convention. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, there's going to be a catastrophic end to the world, you know. But, you know, at the same time, you know, who knows? It's we might make an apocalypse of it if we choose to. But at the same time, I think that people will have many different experiences of life and death, and it all depends on the consciousness that we bring to it. And real quick, there is such a large spectrum in the 2012 discussion. I think that it's just a reality. It's a fact of the phenomenon of the 2012 movement. And I'm really happy to be part of the anthology that Sounds True put together. It's called The Mystery of 2012, Predictions, Prophecies, and Possibilities.
Oh, this is a different project.
This is a book
that
Sounds True is releasing.
Cool, an actual written book.
It's a beautiful hardback book with, you know, contributions from many, many different writers with different perspectives on 2012. It's important to have this kind of thing. So it's long overdue and much needed in the sense that it's one-stop shopping for people that want to sink their teeth into the many different perspectives on 2012.
Sounds a lot like what Jeff Stray's been doing.
Jeff Stray's in it, and Robert Sittler and Peter Russell, Daniel Pinchbeck, Christine Page, Greg Braden, Arjuna Ardag.
Huh.
And many different authors have contributed to this. I really think it's a nice offering. It's over 400 pages, and it's going to be hitting the bookstores here pretty soon. So people have the option of sort of slicing into the 2012 topic from this kind of egalitarian broad spectrum approach, and then they also have the option of going deep into my own work with this through the CD program that's coming out at the same time. They're both being released in a matter of days, September 1st.
Awesome. So. All right, well, I think that's probably going to wrap it up pretty much. John, you got anything you want to finish up with?
Well, that was, you know, it seems to go quick, you know, and there's so much to talk about, and I hope we can talk again soon. If people want an update on I just got back from a 3-week trip to Central America in which I did my various versions of my presentations 6 times in 2 weeks and just had incredible experiences, and especially in regards to the possibility of opening up the site of Azapa to traditional Maya daykeepers to come in and to do a ceremony and ritual at the site, which is sort of unheard of in Mexico, because Azapa is in Mexico, but through some synchronistic connections, it seems like we're going to be able to facilitate that happening in the near future.
Wow, I think that's an important thing to happen.
Absolutely.
Wow, great stuff. And lastly, what do you got on the docket? You got plans to be anywhere in the next few months other than the conference that's going on, the 11th Hour Convention? What else you got on the ticket?
There's the ARE conference at the Edgar Cayce Institute in Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening October 7th, 8th, and 9th. So people on the East Coast can go check that out.
All right, cool. All right, my friend. Well, you're doing amazing work, as you have been for a long, long time, and I'm just pleased as punch to be able to talk to you all about it, sir.
Well, absolutely, Mike, and I want to thank you so much, and thank you for everything that you're doing. It's an incredible service that you provide, and you're a beacon.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and I get to chat with guys like you, so I'll continue to do it as best I can, all right?
Thanks a lot.
Take care of yourself, John.